Okay, let's kick this thing off. I don't know that I'll start with a hey now.
Hey now.
Yeah, hey now. That's right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to In Tech We Trust, episode 64. On today's show, we've got Gabriel and myself, and that's it. So good luck with it. It might be a short show. It might be a long show. We're not sure where this thing is going to go, but we've got some really interesting topics.
In Tech We Trust. Charge we're not sure about.
Okay, so one of the big things that went on recently was the HPE, no longer HP, but HPE Discover show in London. And, you know, I would have liked to have been there. I love London.
You know, I've only been through the airport. I've yet to spend significant time in the country itself, which I'm lamenting. Hoping to get there this year. I'm also looking at, I'll probably be at Berlin for the first time this year as well. So I got some, a little bit of international travel all slated. So I'm excited about that as always.
That's on a solid fire budget.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Hey, so, you know, the last time I was there, not that long ago, back in September, I had my cell phone stolen from me by a couple guys on a scooter. And it's one of my, you know.
So if it's not a gypsy on a train, it's cell phones and scooters.
Exactly. Yeah. But I love London nonetheless.
Were they chavs?
I don't know what that even means. Can we go there? Is that politically correct?
I think chav is kind of like it's British slang for hoodlum or gangster.
Yeah, yeah,
they wear like Burberry and chains. It almost looks like something out of like an 80s rap music video.
No, this was like two ninja guys on a scooter, right? Guy driving and the guy in the back picking the phones out of people's hands, right? It was so great. I was facing the wrong way on a one-way street. I was outside the bar because Google Maps took me to the wrong place, and I was really pissed off at Google Maps for doing this. And so I was trying to – I had my phone out, and I was trying to use Google Maps, and I hear this come up, and it was between me and the building edge. I was on the sidewalk. The scooter drives – there was like 4 feet of clearance there. The scooter drives right by. The guy has great hand-eye coordination, just reaches down, clamps the phone with his hand, and he's off. And I'm just going, hey – asshole, you know, I'm yelling, and it was a great scene. I loved it.
I bet you there's a guy named Finnegan somewhere directing them.
yeah, there was probably a Finnegan somewhere. So, like, the end of that, I don't know if I've told this story before, but the really funny thing is you know, I went in to try, I'm a Verizon customer here in the States. Nobody knows who Verizon is in the UK, by the way. But I went in to electronically, you know, go on the Verizon site and try to turn off my phone. But they've got dual-factor authentication to get into your account. And what they do is they send you a text to your phone, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
And it's like I could not get in. It was really funny. You know, I finally did. I got in through a chat window for sales. And I said, you know, I already have your stuff. I'm already a customer, but I'm really in trouble. And this dual-factor thing isn't working. Nice. And they help. And so they help. But I beat my head against the wall for like 2 hours trying to figure out how to get in and get support without dual-factor authentication where they would send something to my stolen phone.
That's almost as bad as me trying to get a hold of my health insurance company from Tokyo in the middle of the night where, you know, apparently if you want to talk with anybody, you can't speak to a human off hours. But the chat window little thing either would not work. So it was like, all right, I guess I'll just wait till tomorrow to talk to somebody or a human.
What was your emergency? I can't remember.
Oh, I had some intestinal thing that exploded. It wasn't like I didn't break any internal organs or anything, but it had been going on for a week, and I'm like, yeah, maybe I should probably see somebody here because I haven't really been able to eat or do anything, which is the worst because I was so excited to go to Japan and eat all this food, and the whole time I was there, I just wasn't even remotely hungry.
Yeah, it's like going to Mexico. Yeah. I want to eat all this Mexican food. No, you don't. Bring your own water. I don't know what. Yeah, I don't know what the deal is. They can't bring water in an airplane anymore. Okay, so we better get on with the news, right?
Yep.
So we'll talk about technology news. We want to talk about HP and what happened in Discovery there. The fact that they've got a deal with Microsoft or Azure. We want to talk about their Synergy announcement also. That's an interesting thing. That's really an interesting deal. Then there's some things going on in object storage. A couple of companies, Roso Systems, OpenIO. There's a problem in New Zealand, apparently, that the register report on with EMC stuff not working right. That's always kind of fun. And then we just want to talk about the future of SSD pricing, because news came out on that, or at least, who was it, John Furrier or somebody over at...
Yeah, the guys at Wikibon are always doing the analysis on that one. And it's interesting to see that, you know, the claims are... And the claims have always been made that, you know, the price of SSD, we're going to match up to disk at some point or another. And we're probably getting closer to that being a reality with some of these new disks that are coming out. You know, obviously there are things that you can't talk about due to NDAs, but, you know, they've been public. Some of the companies have been public about 16 terabyte SSDs. You know, I have some interesting opinions on large size SSDs versus large size spinning disks and the differences between the two and why you would want to use or not use those. So,
well, maybe we'll get into that now, but I'll just say this. David Floyer from Wikibon, I don't know if he wrote the piece, but he certainly influences their thinking over there on all things storage. Floyer's terrific. And if people don't read Floyer's stuff on Wikibon, they ought to, because David Floyer is a very smart and deep thinker about this business. Then we are going to talk about business. We're going to talk about a little bit about VirtuStream and EMC Dell and how that's affecting that deal. I hope you can talk about that, Gabriel, because I'm a little empty on that stuff.
I mean, yeah.
And then one of our favorite things that we're looking forward to is talking about Stephen Ballmer reacting to Microsoft's earnings call. And we'll just leave it at that for now. And there's some things around the server market that we might want to get to too. So that's the agenda for today, folks. That sound good, Gabriel?
Yeah, works for me, man.
Okay. So let's talk about this deal with HP and Microsoft on Azure, right? They've got something going on. They announced it at HPE Discover. They're doing some partnership thing. Have you read much about that?
There was a flurry of stuff that came out over the last couple of days, coming especially because of HPE Discover happening over in overseas, and most of the news has come out primarily around Synergy, their new converged data center infrastructure stuff that they're calling. I guess they're calling it Synergy and composable infrastructure and all these other things, but there's not so much about. I think that's kind of trumped the Microsoft Azure announcement. And didn't you find some interesting information when you were digging around with some of the websites as opposed to whose infrastructure they would actually be using?
Well, yes, I did. Funny you should bring that up. So, you know, when these deals happen, it's always kind of fun to think about, who's driving this deal? Who wants it more than the other one, right? Because on everything like this, one company usually really wants it to happen, and the other company is kind of like, meh, I don't care. Right. So when in doing a little research and Googling for this, right, I was looking for HP Microsoft Azure. And sure enough, I came to a link to a Microsoft site that's titled Microsoft and HPE Partner to Bring Azure in Your Data Center with Hyperconverged CPS Standard Solution. So doesn't that sound like Microsoft naming convention? Hyperconverged CPS Standard Solution. I mean, if Microsoft can name a product, nobody can, right? So I go to the Microsoft page, and it starts talking about this thing. It's got all this, you know, verbose explanations of these things. And it says the HPE Hyperconverged 250 for Microsoft. Okay, so that sounds like a machine.
It sounds like a 2U box.
It sounds like a 2U box. So there's something like that. I'm looking at the data sheet here, but I don't see a picture of a 2U box. I just see a bunch of verbiage, and maybe that's the new HPE look. But then there was also a link to the Microsoft page where it talks about the Microsoft Cloud Platform System Standard, CS250. And I clicked on that link, and I go to another Microsoft page, Cloud Platform System, and whose servers are featured on that page, do you think?
Hewlett-Packard.
Wrong. Dell. Dell. So in the Microsoft announcement for the HP partnership, there's a link to a page that shows Dell machines. There you go.
Websiting is hard.
Yeah. So who wants this deal? Apparently Microsoft wants this deal more than HP does.
Well, yeah, but you know, it's like I'm always astonished at how big the websites are for the large PC manufacturers or the big OEMs. I mean, there's so much content out there, and I can see how something like that would flub. But obviously, if you're making a big announcement that's supposed to get a lot of visualization, I think you got to do a little bit of website due diligence to make sure that all the ducks align. That falls on a product manager somewhere or somebody within marketing that really, you know, somebody gets fired for something like this usually.
Yeah, so it's like 1/12.
If it's got a lot of high visibility.
Yeah, but nobody gets fired. It's got like 1/12 of a manager at Microsoft, because I've seen the way this works being internal there, right? It's so they've got this cloud platform thing and somebody owns that as part of their job responsibility, right? But it also is part of the responsibility is making sure that all the vendors use it. right? So, you know, Microsoft does it. It's like, we've got this great thing, and Dell, you do it, and HP, you do it, and IBM, you do it, and, you know, whoever else is out there that's worth talking to, you know, you do it too, right? They try to get all of their partners to do this stuff more or less in lockstep. And sometimes the partners just say, forget it, right? It's like, you know, right. vSAN, it's like vSANs, but it's Microsoft doing it instead of, you know, VMware. And so there you go. And they did that. And I just thought it was funny to see Dell servers at the end of a, you know, trailing links for an HP announcement.
Well, like I said, websiting is hard.
It is. Hey, so let's move on though and talk about what's going on in object storage.
Yeah, you know, it seems like that space is definitely heating up. You know, we had some primary players in the space with Scality and CleverSafe and some of the others, and you're starting to see some of those companies get picked up or purchased, and then you're starting to see some new players pop up out of nowhere. Well, you know, OpenIO is, there's an article in the Register about that. Interesting enough, though, they've been around since 2002. And I'm really not quite sure. I've never heard of them. They appear to be a French company. So that's always interesting. You know, and you're starting to see some interesting differentiations. You know, erasure coding is big in the object storage world, and there's different ways to do that. And so between OpenIO and what is this, Rezos?
Rozo?
Yeah, Rozo being the other one, you know, they're trying to differentiate how they're doing erasure coding in their object store platforms, and you know, scale out NAS, where Isilon has kind of been king of the castle for the longest time, and then you had Cumulo come out of stealth last year, starting to ramp up in that space, and then you got a bunch of software players who are not coming to market with an appliance, but with a software stack that you can layer onto some hardware, you know. It's just a maturation of that space. You know, we see a lot of it. We see a lot of object store utilization in the OpenStack clouds, or at least organizations wanting to leverage it. But you probably don't see so much of this in the traditional enterprise anymore. So, you know, for the content delivery networks, for a lot of the people out there that are doing, you know, where they start their storage discussions with first petabyte or 500 terabytes as kind of initial buys. It's interesting to see, you know, more people jump into this space and start to address it, because, you know, we're definitely not we're not shrinking our storage utilization anytime soon.
So I did a little bit. I didn't really look into Rozo, so I don't want to be unfair to Rozo by not being unfair to them on this podcast, right? Because, you know, when you look into this stuff, you always find some things that make you go right? But I did look into OpenIO a little bit. And some things that really were interesting to me is they talk about using sort of small storage. So they talk about this huge super scale thing that will go to exabytes, but they're talking that it's archiving for, well, I guess it's not small files. Speed control cameras, healthcare simmers, voice call recording. So if they're talking about streaming data, these are big objects. I thought at first they were doing small objects, and it's pointless to try to build a superscaler system for small objects because it takes so many objects to get superscaler. But if you're talking about media, that makes sense. But so you know, they have got a distributed system, and you know, one of the problems with anything that gets superscaler is how you manage it and how you find things and how you put Humpty Dumpty back together again when it gets out of sync, right? So they've got, you know, this distributed node with metadata that's distributed and no more than a couple of hops to get to the metadata and find the data, you know. So they've built this interesting, you know, matrix of metadata nodes and data nodes. But one of the things that I thought a couple things, right? They talk about managing exabytes at some point, but so far they've got a petabyte under management. Yeah. a petabyte under management for a company, you know, the development that started in 2006 or whatever like that, 16 people working on it in 2006. Are you kidding me? That's all you've got? That's all you can talk to? You're not trying, right? Well, if that's all they can talk about.
Right.
I'm sorry.
I mean, that's not a viable company. You know, I mean, it's tough enough to break into this industry with, you know, $100 million in funding. It's even tougher to have a product that you've been working on since 2006 and have one petabyte in management. Hell, you know, pretty much any storage company that is out there today has, you know, a petabyte when they come to really start pushing it into a marketing space. That's kind of like the bare minimum. But I just found that was kind of fascinating that they had such a little Well, they're very small. So, well, but it's interesting. It's interesting work, you know. I mean, you know, sure. their new release has a Docker component to it. You know, but this space is growing so fast. I think primarily because of the use of video surveillance in so many organizations. If you look at every state, local government, every city, every town, you know, at least in the United States, has some kind of video surveillance program for the police and for, you know, cameras that look at the large cities.
Body cameras, car cameras, all this stuff.
Petabytes of video floating out there. And that space is, you know, there are very few players that really have captured the last bulk of it. But, you know.
Yeah, so how can they be, you know, that's the thing, though.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing, right? They've been doing this stuff since 2006. There've got to be government agencies in France that they can work with that they could stand up more than a petabyte, you would think.
Right? So, yeah.
You know.
Well, I mean, now that they're in the register, maybe some people will come look at them.
Maybe so. There was one other thing I was going to mention, though, that I saw in here was interesting, right? And they talk about how it's structured by namespace, account, container, and object, and how the containers are flat and this sort of thing. And the metadata that is there allows you to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, right? So if it all falls apart, how do you do it? Well, you crawl the nodes, right? And if I'm just saying, if you've got petabytes,
a thousand node.
If you've got 1,000 nodes, say, and you've got maybe even 10 petabytes, or maybe you've got 50 petabytes, how long do you think it's going to take to crawl all that stuff to put it together? Right, it's weeks, right? And if you, it's weeks. It's going to take them weeks to do.
Yeah, no, it's. I mean, like I say, you got to take a look at that and dig deeper. I mean, it's. I mean, if it's a space you as a listener is interested, it's worthwhile to go out there and take a look. Because I mean, there are more companies popping up in this space to do this stuff. But it's, you know, it's one of those. I wouldn't call it a nascent industry, but I would call it one that's kind of very specifically niche focused.
Yeah. So another thing here, right, is they talk about crawling. It says object integrity checking is done by periodic storage node crawling, right? And I'm just saying, I don't think this can work. And I don't want to pick on these guys unfairly, but you know, it's great to have an idea that works at a small scale, but when you get to a large scale, these crawls do not happen quickly. Just saying.
No, not at all. And you know, maybe they're at a petabyte because they can't scale. I don't know.
Yeah, that might be. That might be a petabyte. You can actually crawl a petabyte. You know, in a day. You know, 10 petabytes might take you 10 days or something like that, right? I'm not sure what the, you know. It'll be interesting if we hear back from them. We didn't know much about them, and they probably don't listen to In Tech We Trust.
yeah. Well, we never did hear from the people who had the what was that storage company that we bagged on a few months back?
Oh boy, I don't know. I can't remember. I mean, we bagged on them.
I wonder if they got any additional sales. I'm gonna have to go back and look.
Yeah, you never know. So another item that we came up with is this problem in New Zealand. Right, EMC outage or something like that.
A 2-day outage. I mean, that's tough. That's a tough one to swallow, you know, to be down for 2 days at a university. Let's hope that it had, you know, I bet you all the students were hoping that it happened right around exams. But, you know, and we've had there's been a few of these VNX. I mean, we don't want to pick on EMC too much, but, and normally we don't, to be honest, it's just odd. But, you know, to have like, I think part of this is part of it's probably the university's fault for carrying a, you know, an old, VNX system that was out of warranty or almost out of warranty. And that's a challenge for companies or for organizations that are looking to squeeze that year five.
Oh, is that the deal? Is it a system that old?
I don't know. It's a VNX 5700. So it very well could be, you know, 3 years old or it could be almost 5 years old. But apparently they had a request for, an RFI out to replace it. And then it went tits up during that period, but a 2-day brownout. Oof.
Well, there are a lot of things that happen in this business that are client caused.
Yes.
Right. And the vendor can never come out. The vendor almost never comes out and says, this was really a stupid client. You just can't do that. But sometimes it happens. And I'm not suggesting that's what happened here. But
no.
I mean, there's all kinds of circumstances, you know, a slippery slope. If in fact they were running on really old gear, and they weren't able to maintain it the way that it needed to, and they were having, you know, capacity or other issues going on, it could well be that they had been warned that, you know, things could get problematic for them, right? So we don't know enough to really, you know, bring the hammer down on anybody here, I guess.
Well, interesting though is they're open to cloud storage for its block and file needs, and then looking at hyperconverse to replace their VNX stuff. apparently the were, you know, if you read the comment sections in the Register article, it was all about sheep. So 600 terabytes of data. I mean, I guess that's enough for the sheep genome.
Well, well, they do
always a dig at New Zealand. I'm guessing it's the UK readership are bashing on their former subjects in the New Zealand colonies.
The reproduction of sheep in New Zealand is always interesting. Isn't that where they did the cloning?
Oh, I have no idea. I think all the cloning that's happening in China right now, they're cloning everything.
Yeah, but they started cloning sheep, I think, in New Zealand. Something else to look up later.
Tangent achieved.
there we go. Rat hole. SSDs. Price drops in SSDs. You highlighted an article there, Gabriel. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, what we're looking at is the pricing, and I believe it was a SiliconANGLE article that was talking about, you know, the price points around SSDs are starting to significantly drop and to match the, you know, consumer grade ones. Now let's set that apart, because consumer grade is definitely different than what we see in the SLC or you know, the eMLC and the higher end drives, but the consumer drives are definitely coming down in price. And I did see an article the other day where, like, you know, some of the Samsung, you know, 960 gigabyte drives were getting down to like $85-$115 a piece. And those are TLC based. They're perfect for your home computer, laptops, and stuff like that. That's amazingly cheap.
Who's got those? But, I want to go get one.
They're all over the place.
Like Fry's
New Egg. Yeah. You can buy it all online, almost nothing. But, you know, they're saying that, you know, by 2017, you know, a 512 gig SSD would be about $45-$50. You know, wow. That's really cheap.
That is
but then,
cheap.
You know, also the sizes, you know, so Samsung came out with their 16 terabyte SSD with 3D NAND tech, right?
Yeah.
You know, so when that hits the market, and, you know, I think that, you know, I look at these things, those are consumer grade usable items. I don't think that a lot of array manufacturers are going to use a 16 terabyte SSD in their systems. And it's because there are some challenges around the viability of those systems, but also, you know, a 16 terabyte drive failure, you know, even if it is SSD, it takes a long time to rebuild that stuff.
That's,
and I think that that's probably why you're seeing just, you know, most of the flash storage vendors are still, you know, the peak that they will actually go up to is like at 3.8 terabyte flash drives, but almost everybody still sticks around those, you know, anywhere from a 240 to a 1.92. Terabyte drive inside their systems because for all kinds of architecture reasons.
Yeah, the recovery is interesting. It makes you change your redundancy modes, and then you end up eating in the capacity advantage that you have.
Well, yeah, I mean, you'll get, you know, a better dollar per gigabyte price point, but at the cost, there's always a trade-off. There's always some opportunity cost given up when you make a switch from one thing to another. It's finding that sweet. It's finding the middle ground. Between cost, performance, and stability that you're looking for when you're trying to design a product. And I know it's hard for end users to wrap their head around a lot of that stuff. They say, hey, you know what, this drive is huge, it's cheap, why can't I get this? And it's $100. Why can't I just throw it in my array? You know, and there are so many more reasons why you can't. You know, I just have to go to my manager and say, yeah, I cannot go to Fry's and buy that 1 terabyte drive for $200 because it'll burn up in half an hour.
It'll take that 5 nines array and turn it into a 2 nines array.
Right. But also, too, though, I mean, like, you know, I can say on behalf of SolidFire, so if we use commercial grade flash in our systems, but also we've spent a significant amount of time, effort, and R&D creating an operating system that can take advantage of those consumer drives instead of having to go out and buy a higher priced eMLC or SLC based disk. And it's, you know, for general purpose use, yeah, I don't mind using it. But when it comes to storing your corporate data, I hope it's vetted a little bit better.
Yeah, I wrote a blog post actually kind of about that this week, which it talks about. The post was about – it was actually written to financial analyst types.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not that they read my blog, but the idea was – and I wrote it on the Tejal site, not my own site. But the idea is that flash was not the big thing. You know, flash was a great equalizer. And it allowed newcomers like Tejal, like SolidFire, like Tintri, you know, like Pure, like Nimble, Caminario. I'm sorry if I left anybody out, right? It opened the door for everybody to come in because it created this new performance level And in some cases, some of the legacy architectures really didn't work very well for Flash. So everybody could get in on, and so it equalized and lowered the barriers to entry. Now what's going to happen, what's really going to differentiate these companies is how you deal with the advantages and disadvantages of Flash. And you just made a great example, right? So using commercial grade Flash, all right? So you have software that's up above that knows how to manage that stuff.
Right.
Right. Those are the types of things that are, you know, eventually going to make the Flash industry work. Not the fact that Flash is there and Flash is getting cheap. Enterprise Flash industry, I should say.
Right. Yeah. Totally different. So, you know, it's horses and courses, whatever. Let me mangle yet another old time phrase.
Hey, so there we go. Horses, of course, and let's bounce. Let's bounce out of there and talk and go back to London and HP Discover and this thing they're talking about called Synergy, which is a really kind of an interesting looking thingamajig. They are, from the announcements and what they're talking about, they now have a new marketing term called composable infrastructure. And I got to say, Gabriel, what was your reaction the first time you read or heard those words, composable infrastructure?
I thought compostable infrastructure because it'll probably sit in the scrap heap.
Oh my God.
Oh, my initial it's like, all right. Right. So, you know, I think we were talking about this yesterday. You know, HP likes to claim, you know, that, or they claim that they came up with the term converged infrastructure, and then they turned around and did nothing with it and watched an entire ecosystem grow up around them and then get left in the dust. And now they're trying to make this new change to composable infrastructure, which has already been put out. The concept has already been, out there for a while. I mean, it's kind of the driving factor behind Open Compute Project and some of those things. But what they're trying to do is take this, take the aspects of, or some of the similar characteristics of Open Compute, what's being done there, and then create kind of a hybrid version for the enterprise. And the questions for me always come back to is like, are customers asking for this? And how do you fundamentally change your IT consumption and deployment models to fit a product that they may not even be asking for? And it's, do developers know how to code their apps to take advantage of new architectures? If they're shifting away from NUMA-based architecture, where we've played around with that in the virtualization space forever, into something different, how much of my stuff do I have to rewrite to take advantage of that? If I'm doing trays of disks and trays of memory and trays of compute, and that I can interchange those pieces or swap them out or run RISC next to Intel and, all of these things, this panacea that they're trying to create, it's like, well, that takes some fundamental architecture and design changes, and then you kind of have to wrap your head around, how do I take advantage of all this stuff? Because if you look at the people who are writing the code for infrastructure today, they've all learned a certain type of infrastructure implementation.
Yeah, but they're probably not going to be writing the code for infrastructure tomorrow.
Or they're going to have to. I mean, it's not like
they'll morph, right?
We're going to get a bunch of new programmers that come out of school, and that 5 years from now, they're like, oh, they're going to be able to write for composable infrastructure.
No. They won't coming out of school. They'll be coming out of DevOps, and they'll have a lot of experience, right?
Well, we hope so.
Yeah, or something like that. So you brought up something that I want to make sure we get back to later, which was the change from NUMA to different types of processors and what that means for the server market,
right? Because this focus seems to be on the hyperscaler, and it's because, hyperscaler, large web scale customers, because that's where the bulk of PC compute purchasing is being done. You could take all of that SMB space, and it would fit in within the data centers of Google, Facebook, Twitter, and a handful of those hyper web scale ones, right? In terms of their buy power and what they pick up on an annual basis.
Hey, so there's this new conference that I went to see a little bit of yesterday, the Software Defined Infrastructure Conference. There is such a thing,
and
it wasn't widely attended there, but I saw some of my favorite peeps there yesterday from the industry. Alex McDonald was there, and S.W. Worth was there.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
But it was interesting. I think it was George Crump, or maybe it was another guy there, Chris Dupuy, who said that over 50% of server sales now go to hyperscale providers, right? Over 50%. So the majority of the market is going into hyperscale. And so I think you're right. I think this thing, the synergy from HP is targeted at them. So here's my take on this. They took the technology that they were trying to develop for Helion and are trying to figure out how to productize it now for people trying to build something similar. Right, they'd been building their own automation stuff for Helion. You know that they had to do that. So when they scrap Helion, right, they have these assets that they can still use. And I think that's what the composable infrastructure is.
Well, I mean, I would think, though, counter to that, though, I think that this is kind of like their next generation Blade platform as well. If you look at they're calling it Thunderbird Synergy System, right? So,
Okay. I didn't catch that.
Yeah, there's a I'll shoot you the link, but that's the new one. And it shows some pictures of what this looks like. And it's an interesting concept. I mean, it is kind of like their next generation Blade. I mean, mm-hmm. If you boil it down to what it really is, it's kind of their next generation Blade architecture. Oh. But they're trying to spin it as something that, you know, is much different, much more newer. And like I said,
and organic, like compost.
Compost, exactly. Compostable infrastructure. Yeah.
So one of the things they talk about, right, in one of the videos that I saw was they were talking about doing templates for specific workloads, right? And that makes a lot of sense, right?
Yeah.
And so if they had been developing this kind of stuff, again, for a Helion, where, you know, somebody could come in and say, what kind of workload are you going to be running on this stuff? And you'd say, well, it's going to be this kind of database. It's going to be this kind of streaming workload. It's going to be this kind of office environment, whatever. You know, they could say, oh, well, we know how to set that up. My guess is, you know, so this notion of having templates to provision resources is a really good idea.
Oh, no. I mean, I think what they're taking from Helion to integrate into this new kind of shift in focus is, you know, rich API ecosystem, right? Self-service cloud model type of infrastructure to simplify infrastructure for cloud builders and cloud provisioners and application creators, right? And that's where a large push in the DevOps and cloudy world is to make things simpler, right? We want to reduce constraints. We want to increase flexibility. We want to be more upfront about what the expectations from infrastructure teams should be. There's a lot of push towards, you know, a single API or a universal API.
Right. And, automation, know, right?
It's a new form of lock-in.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, there you go.
Some
right.
would be saying. It's like, now I have API lock-in. Damn it.
There you go. That's probably what's going on here.
But it's a full spectrum approach, right? You know, they want, you know, I mean, we always hear about the enterprise wanting things to be simplified. And that's, you know, that's why hyperconvergence, I think, has taken off in the way that it has, that it kind of caught a lot of the traditional big iron infrastructure manufacturers off guard because, you know, very simple, very easy. It's, you know, it's your all-in-one printer. Now, your all-in-one printer that you buy at the store doesn't necessarily work for your office with 5,000 people in it, but it works fine for a group of three or four. And so they need to be able to, or the OEMs need to be able to create something similar in its approach for the 5,000 user office instead of the 5 user office.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of this is going. But, you know, getting back to
who's going to own this? Who's going to own this umbrella framework, right? Are there going to be competing entities?
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing that nobody wants to talk about and everybody seems to skirt is that, hey, every organization I go and talk to today, I mean, barring a few key ones, is still server team, storage team, network team, virtualization team, database team. Now you've created infrastructure that they all should be able to work with, but those teams still exist. And now you have all the challenge, all those layer 8 issues come to bear. I don't think the OEMs have...
Layer 8? Is it layer 8? Is that the protein robot?
Protein robot? I have no idea what you're talking about.
I think a human being.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah, yeah. Political, right? It's a layer 8 issue. Layer, right?
Okay, cool.
So then always, you know, the model, the 7 layers, you know, but no, it's, you know, it's just a political issue. So those are the things that, like, we can build all the coolest shit on the planet and make it so that, like, one, you know, a fourth grader can come in and manage it. But then you can take it to an enterprise and there's going to be 10 people that want to manage it. And now you have to carve the whole thing up that you just made simplified and converged into one. So now I'm creating, you know, accounts and all this other crap around it. It's like
role-based APIs.
Right. Yeah. It's like, but that's the kind of stuff that people, and then you have an entire group of people that are thinking beyond that. It's like, dude, I just want shit to work. You know, I don't want to have to, like, call the storage guy to get 5 more gigs of storage space and all this other stuff. And, you know, that's the direction we want to get. But, man, it's a long way off.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting that it's obviously a lot of software for HP, but they're trying to do it to rescue server business, because they still are a hardware company and they don't look like a software company yet. But you know, they're maybe they're trying to make that transition. Maybe they're just trying to use this as something to help sell servers, which gets us into that whole discussion of what's going on in the server business anyway. And is anybody does anybody have a prayer of making money, or is this just a slow road to hell?
Well, it's, you know, revenues are flat, server shipments are higher, but the revenue gain from those server shipments are down, you know, or are relatively streamlined. You look at the industry going back to 2007, and there's a great article in the on the platform that shows essentially no change in server revenue since 2007, and only a slight uptick in the number of server shipments. And which is interesting because servers since 2007 have gotten drastically more powerful. But, you know, we look at utilization rates as well, where, you know, 10% was kind of the norm, 6% to 10% was kind of the norm for the longest time. Server virtualization really has, you know, we almost have a decade of data to chart from now. You're looking more like, they're saying more like 25 to 30% utilization rates now in across the board, which is significant. But then you can always find somebody to quote that older number to validate your design and your route to market. You know, and that's always interesting, right? I thought you found something about somebody, you know, HP was relying on, I can't remember which agency, government agency that had nothing to do with computing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It was the, I'll look this up. But for what it's worth, I just want to clarify for listeners, the article that Gabriel's mentioning is from something called The Next Platform. And it was written by Timothy Prigott Morgan, and we'll put a link to the in the show. But that's it's a really interesting article about the server business. Let me find this thing, Gabriel.
Yeah, no, because I mean it was talking about like units sold, units shipped. So you know, HP had like 609,000 machines to get to 3.82 billion in sales. Dell pushed 501,000 to get to 2.4. And IBM or AKA Lenovo had 242,000. To get to $1 billion. And we look at that, that's a factor of what, a 6.5x increase in revenues. And then obviously Cisco comes in there at about 860,000. And that drove what, $885 million. Their sales are up 13%. So the manufacturers are increasing, you know, it seems like their revenues are, the shipment amounts are going up, but the revenues tend to be a little bit flatter. And then, you know, you start to see, you had HP come in with their Cloud line, which was kind of a stripped-down platform. You had Cisco come in with UCS M series, which is addressing the hyperscale market, and that's kind of a discombobulated server itself, with being able to address different components at different phases. And HP's getting into that as well with Thunderbird, which is kind of like their next gen blade chassis, because the C7000 series is very long in the tooth. And then it goes into discussions around, you know, what Huawei is doing. But then all of them combined aren't anywhere near what, you know, the Inspirers of the world are doing. Because those guys are, you know, when Facebook orders servers, they order 10,000 at a pop. They don't order like, you know, 10, 15 servers here and there. They order like, you know, half a data center worth. But also it was interesting to see kind of like the RISC Itanium architectures, you know, that stuff's completely down. Anybody looking to jump off into that market is, you know,
insane.
It's a billion-dollar market right now. I mean, the IBM Z series market is larger.
Yeah, it's insane. Twofold. There's nothing going on. So I found the announcement page that links to HP's trying to justify, you know, what over provisioning or utilization, right? What people want to know is what utilization is going on in their servers. That's the measurement of how efficient you're running, right? HP's announcement on their site, we talk about, you know, website problems, right? So on the announcement for their new class of system, you know, to power the next era in hybrid infrastructure, HPE Synergy announcement, who do they quote for utilization? And they talk about it as over-provisioning. I'm going to read this because it seems so bizarre to me. In today's typical IT environment, over-provisioning and stranded resources are common. Okay, good. According to the Natural Resources Defense Council, the average server over-provisioning rate is between 82 and 88%. Natural Resources Defense Council, HP. Are you freaking kidding me? Does this have anything to do with the server?
The National Cereal Manufacturers of America Company Corporation.
I mean, I get that. The NRDC, as they're otherwise known, I mean, they're trying, you know, it's an environmental group that's trying to look at this stuff, but what do they know about data center utilization, really? And, if you know, if NRDC people, if you've done a lot of studies of this and you want to come after me, please do, but I don't think you know this business nearly as well as a lot of other people could. And why is HP selecting them for their freaking quote? Does this make sense to you, Gabriel?
Because it backs their it backs the data point that they want to talk about.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. Oof. I mean, you know, that's a very cynical way to look at it, and I'm a very cynical person. So,
yeah, but that's the way this business works.
But yeah, I know. It's like, you know, you find the stat that backs up your assertion, and then, you know, but it's, hopefully you find something that, you know, it's kind of like in debate club, you want to find authoritative sources and ones that are good and not just kind of something.
Well,
but you know, you cherry pick one thing, and it's, you know, we're probably the only people that pick up on it, and, you know, only ones nerdy enough to actually talk about it. So
here's what I'm wondering: who do they use for market research then? If they're using NRDC, you know, for quotes for their press releases about their new cloud, high utilization automated platform, right? What do they use for market research? You know, Greenpeace. That probably wasn't fair. I think Greenpeace is still around. Yeah, you know, it just seems like a non sequitur.
Oh yeah, no worries. I see Greenpeace at my local Trader Joe's. They're always out front handing out pamphlets.
And by the way, I have no problem with Greenpeace. I have no problem with NRDC. I think they're fine organizations. Just, you know, it's just I don't see them being knowledgeable about this business.
You tree hugger.
I'm more than a tree. I mean, I'm out there planting stakes and trees and all that stuff. No, I don't actually. So what else? What else do we have to talk about? How long have we been going? We've been rambling a while. The EMC Dell deal and VirtuStream, which is something I don't get. Do you get it?
I mean, it's not the word we've used is not been consummated.
Yeah.
So I don't think the deal is actually finished yet. So it could be one of these things that backs out. There have been a bunch of speculation on it weighing down the deal and then, you know, making it even more complex around the tracking stock. I just think there's a lot of people that are pissed off that are VMware shareholders because they've seen the shares take such a big nosedive since the announcement of the deal, more so than they have affected EMC. And because of that, they're looking for a scapegoat. Apparently, I mean, I could see them, you know, the VirtuStream deal stopping or that it being pulled out, right? And maybe SAP takes a run at it. You know, because I believe they might have had a bid on the table as well. But
so this is all related to vCloud Air. And
well, to an extent, it is, right? Because I think they merged the vCloud Air team and VirtuStream as a group, right? And I think vCloud Air was probably, you know, it makes sense from that standpoint if you want an umbrella group that's going to manage your hosted services. And VirtuStream was almost primarily all about SAP. And offering those services to customers. And then, you know, VirtuStream, or, you know, not VirtuStream, but the vCloud Air stuff was the, you know, the VMware public integration to do kind of hybrid, you know, managed on premises and then, you know, also bursted into their solution.
Pipe dream.
I just don't know how much, you know, how large that was getting and how much fiber. I mean, you know, everybody else that's in the space is throwing their hands up in the air.
Yeah.
Amazon, Google, you know, everyone else that is got data centers across the planet, you go for it, because we really can't compete against you.
Yeah, nobody
wants.
The
only people that are the managed service providers that are providing some kind of, you know, white glove treatment or special touch, or some of these small ones that are regional that, you know, the company or customer doesn't understand how to get into Amazon or something of that nature. They're the ones that come in and swoop up a lot of that smaller mom and pop stuff. But, you know, the large organizations, you know, the NSA types, you know, that want to put something in the cloud or put it public, they're going after the big dogs, and they're not going to go to VMware for it just because it's not their core competency.
So was this something that was going to be outside of Dell EMC and VMware as an independent entity, or is it still going to be owned by this?
No, I thought it was all – I mean, it was part of the EMC baggage.
Because none of those guys can afford to invest in vCloud Air to make it viable. None of them, right? What's it going to take, you know, to your point, what's it going to take to catch up to Amazon, Google, and Microsoft? $5 billion, $10 billion? What's it going to cost, right? A huge amount of money.
Yeah, they already have enough financial troubles with the deal to begin with. I mean, because they have that $50 billion to make up relatively quickly.
I mean, it's fine to get all warm and runny about the potential of bursting to the cloud, but when you understand that that bursting capability is going to cost $10 billion or something, right? You know, you put your little finger at the corner of your mouth, $10 billion.
Well, but also, it's just, like I said, it's like, I don't know, stick with the things you know, and then you slowly, slow roll into those. But if you're trying to buy into an ecosystem where you don't have the chops, then it's just, that's just a, you know, that's throwing a knife at a dartboard or whatever. You're throwing a dart at the board and trying to pick your next direction. It's not, strategically, it just didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And to be honest, I think people are talking about it because it's the only thing really in the news about the EMC Dell deal. And it's getting a whole lot of attention because it is the only thing in the news about the Dell EMC deal. And so it's like, it's taken a lot more visibility than it would normally be warranted, because in the grander scheme of things, it's not very large. In a $68 billion deal, the $1 billion VirtueStream thing is not really, you know, maybe they're just looking for some fat to cut.
Yeah. Yeah, fat to cut.
And that would be it. Hey, but I like the fat.
We do like the fat, and we like to chew the fat. Hey, Gabriel, did you see Ballmer's reaction to Microsoft's earnings call?
Yes. Lasers came out of his eyes.
This is really interesting, right? Is there a new feud, a new public feud brewing between the old CEO of Microsoft and the new one? It kind of looks that way to me.
No, I think it's somebody who has a lot of money invested in Microsoft asking for more transparency.
Oh, okay. So say more.
Well, if I put myself in Steve Ballmer's shoes, which – I mean, they're probably really nice Italian loafers, and he's got more money than baby Jesus. But if I look at his complaint, it's actually legit, because I think he's saying, hey, you guys have switched how you're reporting revenue. You're not reporting revenue. Okay. You're reporting the run rate, and that's completely different, right? And as you know,
that's kind of cheesy.
Well, yeah, as a large shareholder – I mean, he's probably one of the biggest, if not the biggest, shareholder in Microsoft. To make that change now is interesting, because they've never done it before. And it really only assumes revenue for the entire year based on the present sales figures and not what they're actually doing.
I wonder if there's an in-joke here, right? Because they probably talked about this option while he was CEO. Maybe not.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe they talked about it and he said, no, you can't do that. And they did it.
Right, because he's saying that they should disclose profit margins and sales for, you know, the cloud and hardware businesses. And it's, you know, those are key metrics, as he calls it, right?
Yeah.
And so they're reporting an annualized run rate on sales to a certain point in time to be carried out at a yearly date. And, you know.
That is cheesy.
When you're trying to reach a certain number, yeah, now you can massage it to make it look better, when in reality it may not be anywhere near that, right? Or say, hey, yo, Q4 is going to be bitching. Or we had one quarter that was kick ass. And the next three quarters are going to suck, but we're going to base it off that one quarter and make it look a lot better than it really is. Not to say that that's what Microsoft's doing. I'm sure that they're, you know, they have a CFO who's probably, you know, a genius, and you know, they have an entire, you know, fiscal department that has, you know, does all of these things for specific reasons. But it just seems, if I'm, like I said, if I'm Ballmer and I'm shareholder numero uno next to Bill Gates or somebody else like that, I want to know why.
Do you think that's a ploy to make strategic business initiatives like Azure less transparent for their financial results? That's a loaded question. Hey,
yeah, no shit. You know, it's there are all kinds of places to hide things in a company that large.
Yeah, you know, so something else that I picked up on this was about Windows Phone, right? And we stopped doing secret Windows Phone apps a while back. should have kept them going, but you know. Well, Ballmer apparently doesn't like the way Nadella has handled Windows Phone and the apps. And, you know, he talked about the Starbucks app. And Nadella said something about using a universal application for Windows, you know, that will work for phones, PCs, tablets, Xbox, and whatever. And Ballmer doesn't believe it'll work. And he thinks that they have to have Android apps that run on Windows Phone. And, you know, it's an interesting thing, right? The whole Windows Phone experience. to me, it looks like you've got two guys with really different things that they like, right? Ballmer's a consumer guy. He's not an infrastructure guy. I think that was clear for his whole tenure at Microsoft. Nadella, on the other hand, as we talked about in past, you know, in Tech We Trust shows, is really doing all this really clever stuff around DevOps and building, you know, new infrastructure tools and Azure and all of this, right? I think you got consumer guy versus infrastructure guy, you know, in this company right now.
Yeah.
And it kind of begs the question, you know, years ago after the Justice Department inquiry, you know, and should Microsoft be separated into an OS company and an Office company? I think it really begs the question, should they be doing what HP did, you know, which is looking pretty smart.
Break it out of the consumables.
Yeah, break it from consumer to infrastructure. You know, maybe Ballmer could come back and run the consumer company and the Clippies, you know.
He should have made, like, instead of the Clippy, it should have been him. And, like, you know, and his eyes should have glowed red.
And for those of you in other parts of the world who don't follow basketball, he owns the L.A. Clippers, which we now refer to as the Clippies, you know, sardonically.
He owns the Clippers?
Yes, he does.
What are they still doing in L.A.?
Should
move to, like, Orange County or San Diego. I mean, there's like, do we really need two basketball teams in L.A.?
No. I think they used to play in Orange County, but they decided to move downtown. Yeah, so
yes.
So you're never going to games anyway.
No, I'm not going up to see them. I don't want to go see the Lakers. They suck.
Yeah. So anyway, this will be an interesting thing to watch in the future. You know, this big shareholder in the company that has a lot of inside information from having run it, you know, being critical of the new guy who's making this pivot from being, you know, I'll say fairly, you know, more consumer to more infrastructure. Stay tuned, folks, for quarter-to-quarter action on that one. All right. Finally, Gabriel, we get to the killer part of the show. Hot or not hot?
Ooh.
Ooh. Ooh. Okay. So first thing, $5 Raspberry Pis.
Kind of hot. Because I'm like, you know, how awesome is a $5 Raspberry Pi going to be? What are you going to do with the $5 Raspberry Pi? You're going to put it in your $6 monitor? I mean, it sounds like, you know, it's like, you know, when a computable item becomes the cost of a hamburger, I'm always curious about the utility of it and what I'm going to do with it, right? Because I have Raspberry Pis, and to be honest, I haven't really done a whole lot with them. You know, but then again, I'm not like a Tinker Nerd. So maybe for Tinker Nerds, it's the bomb, because now I can buy, you know, for the price of the regular Raspberry Pi, I can buy four or five of them, and I can create I'm going to create a Beowulf cluster out of my Raspberry Pis.
So I am so with you. I think this is hotter than hell. I love it. Right. So last week you talked about, you know, this consumer technology for kids to build Tinker Toys or Erector stuff,
yeah,
kind of stuff with electronics, right? It's too expensive. $250, you know, for the kit. No, Raspberry Pi for $5, that's the thing, right?
Yeah, but what can you do with that $5 Pi? I mean, can you play Minecraft with it? Because that's all the kids want to do.
You know, you'll probably be able to do something like that without – People are going to build around this thing.
The approach, the price point is so small that, you know, people anywhere can work with these, and, you know, maybe they're targeting a completely different market, or they're targeting, you know, the home based IoT consumer, or, you know, I haven't read a whole lot into it. It's just not my niche, but
yeah,
you know, it's got to be interesting. Something going on there.
Okay.
Somebody will find something really kick ass to do with it. So.
So one more hot or not hot. E-commerce at Facebook and Twitter. Hot or not hot?
Annoying as hell.
I don't even know what that means. What does that mean?
It's just going to turn everybody off and away from the damn platform. I mean, I already have to deal with all the other promoted tweet crap and, you know, things. Twitter's already become like – now Twitter's become just like Facebook, where it's something I just have to check on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I feel compelled. Right? To go, let's go see if anything's or somebody's, you know. I mean, I still put things out there. I do more organic discussion on Twitter, and then there's a few Facebook groups that I'm involved in because they're, you know, they're private groups around technology stuff that, you know, we have discussions on. But for the most part, they've just become like kind of like, you know, OCD hits, right? Oh, check that. All right, move on. Go do other things.
That's the penalty of popularity, Gabriel. You're so popular now that everyone wants a chunk of you. Well, you probably – how many people do you follow anyway? I mean, have you cut down your following?
Yeah. You know, at one point I think it was around 2,500 I was following 2,500 people. It just got to be too noisy, and I think I'm down around 1,700. And even then, you know, a lot of those are other companies. And what I've tried to do, though, is I've tried to go back through and try to follow more people where I'm really interested in what they have to say other than just broadcast BS. So, you know, I've seen some people that have like 70,000 followers and they follow four people. And I'm like, I'm not going to go that route. But, you know, it is an interesting thing, you know, kind of getting your follower to following ratios in line. And honestly, I've never been somebody who's used lists. And I know, you know, like Greg over on the Speaking of Tech show, they're big list users. I just don't have the time and patience to go through and do that. At some point, it would be nice to go through and kind of reevaluate all the follower stuff to because what I do is I go through phases where I'm like, oh, I'm going to start following founders now, or I'm going to start following DevOps people, or I'm going to start following, you know, people focused on, you know, Photon or something like that. And then I forget that I've followed those people for that particular reason just because it's like too much clutter coming in.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that happens. You get an idea du jour and the next thing you know, you're flooded. So here's what I think on e-commerce for Facebook. It's hot and ugly. Right. There's going to be a lot of people that use it just because they're too freaking lazy, you know, to click over to Amazon. Right. They may have a tab up for Amazon, but you know, how hard is it to do anything on a computer? But if you can buy the stuff on Facebook, people will start selling themselves out and willingly endorsing what Facebook is going to turn into an endorsement machine. Just wait. Right. It already is. So people get on there. Boy, do I love this product because it puts, you know, a penny in my pocket every time you click on this link.
Yeah.
Ugly. Very ugly.
Speaking of Twitter, I apparently have a 2D version of myself at the Solid Fire office now because I couldn't make it to the Christmas party. And now I'm terrified what's going to happen with that.
2D, bacon is king.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. I wonder if they replace your head with a big piece of bacon.
No, it's my head, life size, and they'll probably put it on a stick or something, so it's going to be a photo
book. I hope it goes like on a life size horse's body or something. Right? I mean, is Amy behind this? Is she doing this, or you know, who's doing this shit to you?
Kelsey Cook. She's our events planner. She's awesome.
Yeah.
Give her a shout out. She's the bomb. But
yeah. Hey, look, Kelsey, if you're listening to this, you know, think about taking various parts of Gabriel and attaching them to other like life-size creatures. And please post that shit on Twitter.
No, it was funny because remember there was a 2D cutout of Chris Wall at VMworld.
Oh, it was hilarious. Yeah.
And then somebody created a 2D Chris Wall Twitter account that a bunch of people.
So, you know, that whole 2D Chris Wall thing ended up really creeping him out, right? Because it showed up
off. Creeped me out, too.
Oh, yeah, I know. And now there's going to be a 2D you. I tell you, you should probably find a therapist and go there with Chris together and talk about this.
Yeah. Industry people problems. Our 2D likenesses have taken over.
Next thing you know, if you see him sitting in front of a $100 Raspberry Pi desktop, you'll be nervous, be afraid, be very afraid. Okay, I think it's time to wrap this.
Yep, let's kick it to the curb.
Thanks, Gabriel. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. It was definitely fun.